rebellion against the grain. Innovation, grit, creativity, flexibility, choice. These words are ubiquitous in U.S. society, and yet, according to my guest today, they're not neutral. Rather, they, along with many others, are words that block our perception of where power resides in our society. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with John Patrick Leary about the language of 21st century capitalism and how certain keywords are a slippery way of avoiding calling things what they are. Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We live in a time when the differences between creative resistance to capitalism and creative capitalism, healthcare and wellness, rebellion and disruption, and working class power and the commercial slogan of empowerment can be difficult to grasp. So writes John Patrick Leary in his book, Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism, which is inspired by the title by the great Marxist literary critic Raymond Williams, and which seeks to trace the histories and meanings of crucial words of 20th century American capitalism. He argues that these words shape the ways we see the world to our detriment. Leary is visiting assistant professor of English at Swarthmore College and writes a column on language for The New Republic, and he joins me today. Let me start by asking you this. Why does language matter so much? Why is it such contested ground, especially in these times?
Well, I think one reason is just the ways in which our politics in particular and just life in general are, you know, captured by media or mediated through television, the internet, visual media, and other things. So, you know, language is just the grounds in which we meet each other and the ways and the grounds on which we fight out conflicts politically and in other ways. So it's kind of the terrain that we don't often stop to notice or to critique, because it's just the sort of the grounds on which we fight out everything and make sense of the world. But one of the reasons why I wrote the book is that the terrain of language is something that can be quite deceptive and can be quite sort of treacherous. And when you're trying to identify a problem or make a political argument using language that's been kind of appropriated or crafted by your enemies or your and you know, your opponents, you're kind of set up to lose from the beginning. So I wanted to explore the ways in which language kind of betrays us all the time, you know, in ways we may not necessarily always anticipate.
You know that it's easy to assume that our times are unique, and the dominant language, of course, underscores that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
That said, is there anything unusual about the way language is deployed under 21st century capitalism?
There is and there isn't. I mean, one of the things that I came to understand in the process of writing the book is that it's very easy to slip into the, well, what, if you'll excuse this minor piece of academic jargon, the presentist perspective that kind of dominates our time, or the what someone else has called the temporal narcissism of any particular person who thinks that the moment in which they're living is the most important, or the moment in which they are living is the most decisive. But the language of neoliberalism is very intent on asserting how up-to-date and modern it is. You know, that's why innovation is one of the key words of our time. You know, everything is an innovation, everything is new, everything is the next generation. And it's easy to kind of get sucked into that, to that logic. And one of the things I tried to do was to think about how much of the vocabulary that bothered me so much in advertising and in business rhetoric and so forth was itself just a repurposing of much older stories and much older ideas. That said, there are a lot of things that are peculiar to the language of the 21st century economy. Basically, the language of 21st century capitalism, one of the things that's new about it is that it wants to repurpose every sort of sphere of life, from the spiritual to the athletic to the life of children, as something that can be captured by the market, as something that can be made, that can either be commodified directly or is just part of your training for your future job. And so this way in which, you know, every sphere of life is part of business and part of profit making is one of the things that distinguishes our time. I guess what's particularly distinctive about our time is the extent of that move. You know, there was an article in New York Times recently by Brendan O'Connor about summer camps for children that are pitched as entrepreneurial summer camps. And the idea behind these kinds of camps is that children in the summertime, and actually children all year long in traditional schools, have all this excess of imagination and energy and creativity, but they're not coming up with any good business ideas with those things. So they're wasting it, you know, so they're just sort of spending their imagination fruitlessly. And so the idea is to kind of channel that into a some kind of field that could be turned into a marketable product. And so that kind of like perversity, I mean, I think it's a perverse thing to treat children's imagination as just sort of an unrealized source of profit. It marks our time. And I think it's something that is consistent across, you know, the history of capitalism for 200 years, this constant desire to expand into realms that we thought were once free of the profit motive or buying and selling. So in certain ways, we live in a particularly unique moment. And in certain ways, the things that seem so, to me anyway, seem so distressing are part of a long tradition and kind of link us to people in earlier moments.
Well, let's talk about some of these words, and you group them into four general categories, although obviously these categories are not mutually exclusive. There are dominant words that draw on descriptions of the human body to describe corporations. There are ones that really are about the workers themselves that focus on the moral virtues of the ideal worker under 21st century capitalism, entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. resilience, and that kind of thing. And then there are those that you see as connected to the aesthetics of late capitalism, which describe the worker, and this is usually the white-collar worker, of course, as the mm-hmm. artist, the curator, the maker, etc. And then there are a whole category of words that have their origins in technology. And so just looking at those in turn, let me start by asking you about words that draw on descriptions of the human body. Give us some examples of those words and tell us why you think these words are being deployed by those who either would legitimize capitalism or sort of are the functionaries within it.
So the main examples that I talk about are lean. So lean production is a term originally associated with Toyota Corporation, and it's now a very widespread ideal of corporate and industrial organization. So lean, nimble, which is a popular one from the business press and from the mainstream press. Organizations always want to be nimble, robust. And brand is an important one that people often don't think of as a bodily metaphor. But the word brand originally referred to a mark seared in flesh, either an animal or also, and this is the thing people often forget about, a person in the United States. So the thing that these words have in common, and they all have somewhat different lineages and different histories, as I sort of alluded to, but the thing that they basically have in common is the fact that they all work to frame work as a kind of athletic contest that's governed by fair and transparent rules. So if you're a nimble corporation, for example, you are a corporation that works efficiently and makes the most out of your workers and makes the most out of your resources. I mean, nimble is another way of thinking about the word nimble is that it's just a euphemism for that's used when people are fired. You know, a nimble corporation has low labor costs. But that's the other, I think, work that the body talk of late capitalism does is that it thinks about businesses and corporations as human in every way, except as a organization made up of human bodies who work and who are strained and who are tired and who don't get the rest that they require. So that's the work that they do. They humanize the corporation without really respecting the humans in the corporation.
And then what about those that look at the moral virtues of, well, not just simply 21st century capitalism, but often the people who are supposed to work and make it all happen? And for this group, you mentioned things like innovation, entrepreneurship, resilience. Yeah. Why do you think there's such a strong moral dimension to these very common words?
Yeah, I mean, so this is another example of the ways in which the vocabulary of late capitalism is new and also very old. So the moralism of business rhetoric is a very old story. I mean, Benjamin Franklin is often considered to be the pioneer here, the associating business success with a kind of moral virtue is the you know, the major theme of his autobiography. So this is something that has a long history, especially in the United States. But what's peculiar about the modern version of it, and it comes out a lot in words like innovation, creativity, as that word is used to describe things like the creative class or creative industries, is the way that contemporary business rhetoric really identifies with rebellion and anti-orthodoxy, things that once would have signified a kind of world that was outside of the business world or hostile to it, you know. But now you see all these examples in which you see it in advertising, you see it in the way that sort of Silicon Valley corporations in particular, it's a good example of this, pitch themselves as these kind of, you know, people who move fast and break things and so forth, this kind of ideal of business anti-orthodoxy, which is an orthodoxy of business to be anti-orthodox. And so that kind of co-optation, I would say, of rebelliousness. And then the kind of vocabulary of passion and creativity, things that belong to realms of life, art, sexuality, love, religion, that I think we once might have thought outside of what business and business people and business writers were concerned with, are now taken to be the kind of fount from which business inspiration springs. So there's nothing that can't be turned into a new business idea. And so that kind of that appropriation of rebellion and anti-orthodoxy, I think, is one of the features of this contemporary vocabulary. And innovation is an example of that, because it's a word began its life as a word to describe false prophets and heretics and conspirators. So it was originally a very pejorative term, and it still contains that sense of heresy, except now we have been taught to think of that heresy as being constructive and a force for progress.
I'm speaking with the author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism, published by Haymarket Books. His name is John Patrick Leary. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what you've just described as the language of innovation and these moral virtues aligns into another category of words that you point to, which is those that describe sort of the aesthetics of late capitalism, particularly to do with the worker. Now, I think it would probably be fair to say that this tends not to be a word that is used to describe blue-collar workers or workers who are in the lower wage part of the service industry, but more professional white-collar workers. But terms like curator or maker, artisan, which is, of course, ironic because this is a world as far away historically as it's ever been from, you know, an economy based on artisans. But these words circulate now.
Yeah, I mean, so part of it is related to the moralistic or religious vocabulary that I mentioned before. So the ways in which contemporary capitalist culture wants to present itself as rule-breaking and anti-orthodox, and that draws on a certain idea of what the artist was as a, you know, an individualist alone by himself, and it's usually himself in a artist studio doing things, doing radical rule-breaking things. So I think part of the idea of the artistic vocabulary of capitalism is to present this as something that's totally individualistic, as something that individual people, individual geniuses, you know, visionaries do. And that's very linked to the, I think, the point you were alluding to about the ways in which the vocabulary I'm talking about is one that kind of often imagines that there is no factory floor, there is no assembly line, there is no repetitive, humiliating, degrading, or just simply tiring work to be done. And that everybody, and of course, many white-collar jobs, I've had a few of them, are all of those things, you know. But the fantasy, I think, that is sold through this language is one of self-realization and endless creativity and boundless individualism. And so that's part of it is, part of it's that.
Well, and a fourth category of words you say have their origins in technology. And yet, would it be fair to say that so many of these, the terms that we've even touched on so far, putting aside terms like hack or data or whatever, that many of these do originate with the self-image of Silicon Valley and its dissemination into other sectors of the economy?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's the major association now. And again, it, you know, there is a longer history. The idea of the maker that is so popular, I think, in the tech economy is a kind of descendant of earlier, and people have written about this in ways in which, you know, Stuart Brand and the early Silicon Valley people drew on certain critiques of you know, of mainstream capitalism to rebel against disciplined, organized drudgery and to, you know, bring artistry back into everyday life.
And you're referring to the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, Stuart Brand.
Yeah. So the ways in which a certain kind of technological utopianism informs this contemporary, like, culture of Silicon Valley has a longer history. So, so it's not totally unique, and it's not totally, you know, it's not an invention of the last 10 or 20 years. But I guess one of the functions of words like, say, smart, which is one of the words I talk about, is that it invests technology with a kind of human personality and a kind of human benevolence. And then words like sharing, for example, do the same. And they also emphasize the newness, and therefore, because we often associate, because of the dominance of concepts like innovation, we associate the new with the good. These technological terms associate new novel technologies with a kind of social progress. And so you think about a term like sharing. It suggests cooperation, collaboration, a kind of solidarity, even when you're talking about the sharing economy. And that's the ideal of the sharing economy, right? That we're sharing our, we're pooling our resources, we're opening our homes to to guests and strangers. I mean, that's the kind of fantasy of what Airbnb does. But another way of thinking about sharing, in the case of, say, Uber, is that it's just a technological update to sharecropping, you know, or to tenant labor, in which you're paying someone else to use their tools, in which someone else is profiting off of not only your work but also your own personal property. And so there's a way in which the novelty that technological terms like sharing and smart sell a kind of vision of progress that their actual economy belies all the time.
Well, and one of the things that's so striking in looking at these words that you're flagging, these keywords that you're saying are really emblematic of the capitalism that we're living under today, is how many of those words have that kind of egalitarian charge, right? I mean, you mentioned sharing, mm-hmm. but peer-to-peer is another. That the power of so many of these words is that so many of them we actually associate with a much more progressive or even radical impulse of social movements in previous decades that then have mm-hmm. been subsumed into capitalism today with, as I say, this sort of egalitarian veneer to it, so that, as you note, workers' power, social power becomes this disembodied empowerment, which is certainly not a collective empowerment, or rebellion mm-hmm. turns into technical disruption. Mm-hmm. And it seems like capitalism has, and particularly the form of capitalism that we live under now, has a particularly strong ability to appropriate these terms from more rebellious sectors of society and from the left and, mm-hmm. and repurpose them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a point I really want to emphasize, because a lot of, you know, my evidence from this book, a lot of my examples come from the business press or from Silicon Valley. And a lot of people, I'm sure many of your listeners, love to roll their eyes at the kind of grandiosity of Silicon Valley or the kind of lingo of the business world. But it's worth remembering how much of this kind of language sort of penetrates even the vocabulary, even of people like me or people like your listeners who probably are involved in organizations that are trying to redress some of the abuses of the 21st century economy. And so a couple of the examples you mentioned are really important there. I think empowerment being one. So this is a word that got its start in feminist critiques of international development and feminist critiques of the Black Power movement. So the idea of empowerment was that it was supposed to make visible and to emphasize forms of kinds of work, like housework, like teaching, like informal kind of mentoring or work that, you know, we would loosely describe as care work, that didn't get measured by the typical metrics that assess the productivity of a particular place. So that kind of work that's unwaged and that generally is like unmeasured and invisible. But it has become a kind of feminist corporate slogan that is used to sell products to individual women who might think of themselves as progressive or as feminist. So it's been emptied of its political content, emptied of its political critique, and emptied, as you mentioned, of its kind of social and collective content to become just this kind of brand idea that any individual person with enough money anyway can access. Or it's become just simply associated with status. So to be empowered means to have a good job, or it means to be financially independent. And that's a kind of that's a way in which a critique of power has become just a kind of myth of individual success.
Do you have any sense of how words have taken that journey? Obviously, different words have different trajectories. And you did mention how Silicon Valley drew on the counterculture and crossed over with the counterculture of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so that's one route for some of these words. But others, I think if we stop to think about them, we would associate with human resource departments across the country. Mm-hmm. How do you think some of these words went from the left to management speak?
Well, yeah, it's a complicated history, and I'm still kind of digging into a lot of it. I think, I mean, part of it is a concerted effort by conservatives after the New Deal to invest capitalism with a sense of the freedom and romance and excitement that it had lost for good reason during the Depression. And so in the 1930s and 40s, you know, conservatives like Friedrich Hayek, economist, famous hero of the conservative movement, was outraged. He was sort of like the version of, if I'm outraged by empowerment and innovation entrepreneurship, he's sort of like my doppelganger in the 1940s who was outraged by Social Security and things like that, for the words associated with the New Deal. And the idea was that, you know, you got you were free if you were free from the vagaries of the market, of the, you know, the capitalist market that could cause you to lose your job, cause you to lose your land, or whatever. And so the task was to come up with an idea of freedom through the market. So the way in which this starts to get sold is through these ideas of innovation and entrepreneurship, ways in which you could set yourself free, be unbound by the factory floor or the wage system, and kind of pursue your own destiny through investing and through starting a business. So part of it is deliberate, I think. And I think, you know, the right is always kind of, in general, recognize the power of language very clearly. So, you know, when you think about things like the death tax, or you know, the kind of Republican euphemism for the for a tax on inherited estates, you see how there's a kind of a very deliberate strategy about changing language to change ideas. But then sometimes it's, you know, it some of the origins of these terms or their circulation, and it's hard to trace a particular scheme behind it, or a particular, you know, there's not like a conspiracy to celebrate the sharing economy, or necessarily, I mean, there's not like these words were cooked up in a boardroom somewhere, but they circulate through the business press, you know, Forbes and Entrepreneur magazine and so forth. They circulate through Harvard Business Review. They circulate through business schools, and they circulate through the vast literature of business advice, self-help, and management books. You know, the books you see in an airport bookstore, which is a, you know, a huge publishing economy.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking with the author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. I'm speaking with John Patrick Leary. The book is published by Haymarket, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is also the author of A Cultural History of Underdevelopment, Latin America in the U.S. Imagination. Well, you mentioned a bit earlier that one of the characteristics of capitalism has been its ability to turn into commodities things that had been outside of the market before. And clearly, social movements, when they spring up, can also provide often a new market. And it would seem as if capitalism, late capitalism, has been particularly attuned to this since the 1960s and 70s. One of the words that made me think of this was the term DIY, a ubiquitous mm-hmm. term, do-it-yourself, which you point out comes partly from home improvement, obviously, the language of home improvement dating back to the 50s. But it also comes out of a moment of rebellion in the UK in the 1970s, which was punk. Tell us about this term, DIY.
Yeah, so DIY, I became attuned to this word when I read an opinion article in the New York Times that was attempting to float a solution to the vast underfunding of New York City public housing. You know, like every city in the country, New York City's public housing has billions of dollars in unmet repairs. So this critic was attempting to float an idea of a DIY solution for the public housing crisis, which was to train residents to do their own repairs, you know, to fix their own plumbing, to fix their own plaster, to fix their own mold infestation. And the idea of the critic's idea was that this was a kind of, to use one of my words, an empowering solution, because it would put the residents themselves in control of their own living conditions. Of course, the idea was to force residents who are paying rent to do their own repairs, the things that they're supposed to be already paying for. So it was like a lot of the words in my book, it's a way of selling as an empowering, liberating thing, the defunding, the stifling of the public sector, the privatization of everything, and to sell these things as like actually empowering and liberating, you know, so you do your own repairs. And there's an element in the history of DIY as a term that supports this. I mean, it's a it's about doing yourself, not relying on someone else, not being fleeced by a plumber, but doing your own plumbing. And it's about owning your, you know, it's a term that comes from home ownership. So it's about also being the master of your own domain, you know, and it's a term that has long been associated with a certain kind of American masculine ideal. So there's that sense of autonomy, and then there's the rebelliousness that is associated with punk, you know, the idea of DIY and punk, where you, the aesthetic that's made up of clothes you make yourself or magazines that you make yourself from cutting out bits from other magazines and stapling and gluing them together. So that idea of a kind of creativity and a kind of culture that was done by the people themselves and not relying on big corporations for help. But when those ideals are turned into a justification for the disempowerment and defunding of actual public goods that people deserve and should have, then it's kind of emptied of its original political content and just used as an excuse for cost cutting.
Well, I'd like to ask you about two other words that seem to be emptied of their political content that we would associate with the environmental movement. One is sustainable, the other is ecosystem. Tell us about those two terms.
So sustainable is an old word that used to just mean the ability to keep on doing something. So when it first got used to talk about the economy, in American newspapers, it was to talk about profits being sustainable. So the Wall Street Journal would talk about the Chrysler Corporation's profits look sustainable this quarter. And then it became a term associated with the environmental movement, especially and around the Rio Earth Summit, which happened. It was a UN conference in 1992 that celebrated sustainability, or you know, put forth sustainability as the ideal of the environmental movement in order to find a kind of development that meets the needs of the present without compromising future generations. The problem with that idea, which is, you know, basically a fine idea, but the problem with it is that it's unambiguously good, you know, because no one wants to be exhaustible, but it's also invitingly vague. And so when you think about the environmental meaning of sustainable, along with the old business meaning of sustainable, you get results like BP or McDonald's or Duke Energy celebrating with perfect conviction their commitment to sustainability on their websites or on their public relations platforms. Because and you can't necessarily say that they're lying, because BP is no longer dumping millions of gallons of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. They're more sustainable now than they were when they were dumping millions of gallons of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. So because sustainable is a term that sounds good but can't actually be measured against anything, you can always be a little more sustainable than you were yesterday. So it's a way in which a certain kind of laudable political movement, in this case the environmental movement, can get appropriated and turned into a corporate slogan that loses the original sense of a political critique that it had.
And then the term ecosystem, what's its origins?
So ecosystem, we hear this word all the time, used to describe a network of businesses in a particular place or a supply chain or a kind of industry. So, you know, the Apple ecosystem or the Maker ecosystem in San Francisco or something. And it's a kind of management buzzword or a management enthusiasm. And one of the things that it does, most obviously, is that it naturalizes business and naturalizes our current kind of business world as if it's as if it is natural, as if it belongs to Mother Nature. That's a feature that a lot of the terms that I talk about have. So synergy is originally a biological metaphor, refers to the kind of interaction of cells. And then we use words like business climate to do a similar thing. So, and these are kind of words we use often without thinking about it, without thinking about the kind of implications. Or an incubator, for example. Let's talk about some institution that nurtures young firms. But one of the things that an ecosystem also does, and the word got popularized by the Harvard Business Review in the 90s, is that, like the body talk that frames business as a kind of athletic contest that's governed by fair rules, an ecosystem is something that is thought to be in balance. And so it's natural, and it's also balanced by the various forces at play. And so if you're a smart business person, you can become the predator in the ecosystem, in the business, in the innovation ecosystem, or in the business ecosystem of whatever field you're in. So there are ways of framing capitalist economies as complex, but also very local, as competitive and ruthless, as a system of predator and prey, but also fair, and also as bountiful as Mother Nature herself is. And so it's not something that when we talk about a kind of business as an ecosystem, again, the thing we're not talking about it as is a workplace. So a place shaped by competing interests, by bosses and workers, by winners and losers. We're only thinking about it as a place of winners and of just endless wealth and boundless productivity.
I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm speaking with John Patrick Leary about his book, Keywords. He's visiting assistant professor of English at Swarthmore. So one of the things that struck me as I was reading through Keywords and looking at all of these absolutely ubiquitous terms that help shape the way we see the world and we see the possibilities of the world, I was struck by how so many of the terms, which, you know, we could crudely call corporate speak often, are the terms of the nonprofit world as well. And Looping back to my question earlier about how often these words have been appropriated from the left and from social movements, today often, maybe not the left, but sort of progressivism and liberalism, often nonprofits are the realm in which liberalism operates. And it struck me how these terms are also the language of nonprofits. Terms like stakeholder, terms like the conversation, yes. You know, the national conversation. We need to change the conversation. How do you see nonprofits in all of this?
Well, yeah, they're definitely very much involved, and that's one of the things that I like I said before, I want to kind of emphasize the ways in which we're all, most of us anyway, are implicated here, and we have to be kind of vigilant about the kind of language you use for the implications that it has and for the ways that it sort of shapes our political imaginations and our sense of what's possible. So conversation, to take that one first, I mean, that's maybe a somewhat easier one. It's a word that's used a lot in the media because, you know, that's who you're quoting when you're talking about join the conversation or let's have a national conversation about X, Y, or Z. Usually it's used in the context of race. So Bill Clinton is often credited with popularizing the idea of the national conversation on race. And a conversation, when you think about what it means literally, you know, you and me are having a conversation right now. It's what two people who are peers do in a friendly way and a casual way. Surely, if the United States is reckoning with its racist history, the way to do that is not through a conversation between people of who are, of course, on opposite sides of that racist conflict, but through some sort of more forceful measure. So a conversation is something that takes place among equals, and it has a way then, therefore, of obliterating the actual power dynamics that make a conversation on race actually necessary in the first place. So one of the things I think that a lot of these words do is they kind of, in the interest of promoting a certain kind of ideal of equality, they paper over the power inequalities that actually exist and that one can't simply ignore or talk away. And stakeholder is another example of that. So the word itself refers to a kind of financial transaction. I mean, a stake is a financial stake in a venture. That's the original meaning of the word. The concept of the stakeholder that we kind of talk about now when a nonprofit organization talks about getting its stakeholders together, actually, this is one of the words that does have a kind of specific history and an author. And the author is a Harvard law professor named Merrick Dodd, who developed the term first during the Great Depression, when he was arguing for a kind of more responsible notion of corporate behavior in a moment when public opinion was very anti-big business. And so his idea was that businesses needed to talk about themselves as having obligations not only to their shareholders, but also to their employees, to their customers, to the general public, to the person who owns a diner down the street from the factory, to the public school teachers in the district where the headquarters were located, and so forth. So it was an idea of selling a certain kind of corporate responsibility as a way of, I think, blunting some of the popular anger against big business during the Depression years. And that's on the one hand a kind of laudable idea to think about a business as having obligations to the people in its neighborhood. But the first problem is that it's sort of framed as a voluntary thing that you should do just out of because it's a good business decision. And secondly, it does the same thing that the conversation does. It frames stakeholders as if they are equal, and they never are. I mean, the person who, the public school teacher next to the headquarters, doesn't have the same stake in the operation as the executive does, nor does the executive have the same stake in the operation as one of his or her assembly line workers do. And so when we talk about stakeholders, we are assuming that everyone has the same stake, but everyone never does.
We've been talking about the language, the ubiquitous language that emanates out of corporate America, but we all seem to breathe, and red flags don't go up when we hear these words often. You know, they have become mm-hmm. so commonplace. But it would be, I think, accurate to say that whether it's in nonprofits or within the professional white-collar jobs, that these tend to be the realm of people who are of that stratum of the working class that is educated, professional, and so on. Are there words that you think characterize our time, this period of 21st century capitalism, that are deployed particularly for blue collar workers? Are they expected to sort of go along with this language, and do they, or does it operate in a different way for them?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the language that I talk about is used to describe factory work. So lean being a good example, lean production.
Sure.
And some of the language I talk about is directed at service workers. So none of the stuff I talk about is language that originates from workers themselves. I mean, this is my book is a kind of chronicle of a dominant ideology and an mm-hmm. attempt to criticize it and hopefully to help undermine it. So with that in mind, you know, I'm one of the things that distinguishes this language is the fantasy that that nobody works hard, basically, that nobody sweats, and that nobody has a painful job. You know, that everyone is just sitting at their computer doing creative things all day. But some of the ones that that do touch on what you might call a working class or blue collar economy, and you know, one of the things that I think I would say is that those old terms don't necessarily always describe the things that we want to describe very well. So, for example, flexibility, that's one of the body talk words that I talked about, along with robust and lean and nimble. It's often used to describe schedules in service economy jobs, or in the sharing economy. So the Uber celebrates itself for offering drivers flexible schedules. Starbucks or a retail, you know, a department store or a clothing store or something, some sort of retail operation will brag about the fact that it offers its employees flexible schedules. The other side of that, and this is a word that seems to suggest a certain kind of freedom, you know, you're not bound by the 9-to-5 schedule. You're not bound by the whistle of the factory or something. But flexible scheduling also means for people in the service economy, a totally unpredictable and unmanageable schedule, that it can be changed at any moment, that you're only brought in when you're absolutely necessary. And, you know, employers have all kinds of software to manage these kind of schedules and to basically extract the most out of their employees as possible. So these are like, this is an old story, you know, this is kind of what any business owner tries to do, to extract the most value out of his or her employees as he or she can. One of the things that distinguishes the vocabulary of contemporary capitalism is the effort always to sell these kinds of profit maximization strategies as being somehow like liberatory, or as being somehow modern and progressive. And flexible is a good example of that. You know, you're expected to bend in every way. The word seems to suggest a certain kind of agility and freedom. But what it really means is that you have to bend in every direction your boss demands.
Let me end by asking you about language on the left. You mentioned mm-hmm. that you think it's important that we be aware of the ways we're using language, which often may feel neutral to us, when the language has a history, the language actually has a content that may be different than what we think, and hence it sort of shapes how we think. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that the left, particularly when it has been marginalized, has fixated on language to a degree which could be argued is just excessive. That, you know, if we use the right language, either the scales will fall from the eyes of the public and they will see how things really are, or, you know, that there have been these battles over language that have been, I think, a product of the left's isolation. So how do you think the left should approach these questions of language?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I I don't think of myself as the language police, and I certainly don't think that language, as I talk about it, has any sort of magical properties. So if you simply stop saying innovation so much or entrepreneurship so much, that something will dramatically change.
Sure.
And I also, and I share your, I think, your sense that the left has often been stymied or driven into these kind of self-defeating battles over over language that are, as you said, a product of isolation. So, like, whether you say the right words or not, and if you don't say the right words, you're cast out, or you're not allowed to talk anymore. I'm less interested in using correct language or in emphasizing what is right and wrong in the way that I talk about it. And that's a kind of inheritance of Raymond Williams. I mean, he talks about in his original book called Keywords that he is not sympathetic at all with what he calls a sacral attitude to language. So the idea that there is a correct term or a correct way of using something that must be honored. But I'm interested in kind of thinking about the ways in which language gets used and the way that it gets changed and the way that it gets manipulated over time and the way people give their own new twist to it. I'm interested in the creativity of people. I think that as far as like the language of a anti-neoliberal left is something that I can't claim to be able to, or I don't think anyone should claim to be able to kind of sit down and write it or say what it is or say what it should be and say what it shouldn't be. I think it'll come out of struggles and it'll come out of attempts to find a new way forward to celebrate solidarity and to celebrate public goods and to celebrate a kind of collaboration that isn't wedded to profit. And what those words are, it's sort of exciting to be able to say, I don't know what that language will be. That's part of the idea of a radical or revolutionary change, is that you don't know exactly what it'll look or sound like.
Well, on that uplifting note, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, sure. It was a pleasure. Happy to end on an uplifting note. It doesn't often happen with me.
John Patrick Leary is the author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. That's published by Haymarket Books. And at againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that. He is a visiting assistant professor of English at Swarthmore College and writes a column for The New Republic. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.